Hi, everybody. Jim, alcoholic.
My
sobriety date is May 26, 1987. My home group is up in Portland, Maine, the Sunshine Group. And the first thing I want to do is thank all you maniacs in the crowd for helping me find freedom and giving me hope. So thank all the Mainers. There's a whole handful of people that came here for support, and I'm very grateful for that because these guys taught me how to live. So when I got here, I talked to Eber on the phone about the topic we were going to talk about with pain, and I said, okay, I don't need to do any research on that one. I'm good. I don't need to write any notes, or it's just going to come out, and I'm going to talk about my experience with my pain level. So I was 23 years old. I grew up in the projects of Portland, low-income housing, and I didn't think there was a way out of there. I didn't have any hope. I grew up less than. I grew up playing sports and then finding that I didn't fit in with the kids that had a little bit of money. So I decided not to play sports anymore after freshman year in junior high. And I did what the basketball court people were doing, which was drinking every day. And I thought that I would die there. So my first experience with pain and asking for help, which was something I was told if you ask for help, it's a sign of weakness from the older guys I grew up with. I watched my buddy attempt suicide a handful of times with a 9mm, a knife, his car, and he just didn't want to live. And after a five-day drunk on Memorial Day weekend, May 26, 1987, I said, hey, what's your next plan? And he told me about it. And let's just say, I don't need to go into details, but I was pronounced dead. And somebody found me at 3 o'clock in the morning. They dragged me out of a car and did CPR on me. And I went to work a couple hours later. And they said, what are you doing here? You're fired. You haven't been to work in a while. We used to get paid on Wednesdays, and they stopped paying us on Wednesdays because of me. I wouldn't go to work on Thursday, so they started paying us on Thursday, and then I didn't show up on Friday. And then we started getting paid on Friday. And then before I knew it, I had 5 written reprimands, which they never did before, but you're supposed to get fired after 3. And the owner really liked me for some reason. I was an apprentice in the sheet metal program, and nobody else did it but me, and I went to school at nights, and I drank every day at work. And the owner said, he needs help. He's a drunk. And they did an intervention on me in the shop foreman's office, and they said, if you want your job, you're going to go to this place called Jackson Brook Institute, which was right down the street from where I worked. And they said, well, keep your job. I said, yeah, but my car's repossessed, and I'm kicked out of my apartment. I have no place to go. I'm living out of my car. And they said, are you willing to go to this 28-day program? And I said, yes. And I haven't had a drink since. Wow. Nice. So I was 23 years old, just a young punk, and you guys taught me how to become a man. I never wore stuff like this back in the days. I came in here with heavy effing metal t-shirts with long blonde hair and a mustache. And I look a lot different now. And I used to wear a hat after I first started going bald because I had a complex. And then I said, you know what? I'm a middle-aged person and I accept that now. And I started shaving my head about 10 years ago. And now I'm part of the bald community. And I'm okay with it because I'm 51 years old now. And holy cow, where's the time go? So 28 days in this rehab, I had to work on surrender every day. And when I left there, they gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, kid, if you want to stay sober, there's a place called the Sahara Club in Portland on Conga Street. You go there and you talk to the old timers and you read this big book. And if you want to stay sober, you're going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did that. And at first, the pain for me was I didn't believe in a higher power. You guys use that word G-O-D. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't know anything about it, but I don't want it. What I found out is every time I went into a meeting, whatever you guys were talking about, I was identifying with, and whatever you had, I had it. I didn't care what you called it. I don't care if they called it a disease or whatever it was. I identified. I looked around the room at the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and I saw the third tradition that says, if you have a desire to stop drinking, you belong here. That kept me here for 18 months because I thought I was too young to be an alcoholic. And after a while, the old-timers talked to me enough and told me that the stuff that I was doing, I was going to drink if I kept doing what I was doing, which was self-will run riot on page 60 to 63 in the big book. They taught me how to read that to get out of the driver's seat and find a higher power and not use my will, because my will thought at 23 years old the world was done and I didn't care and I was very negative. So I was in a conversation with this old-timer, and he wasn't really an old-timer yet, but he was old. To me, I was 23, and everybody over 50 seemed really old. And here I am. So the first meeting I went to, they used to take this van, and they'd bus us all around to the meetings in Portland area. And we go to this meeting. I don't know what to expect. I've never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's a guy standing in the doorway, and he reaches out his hand, and he says, "Welcome, young man. My name is Bill G. Nice to see you." That was the first guy I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to mention his name because he was a mentor for me for many years. He taught me how to become a man by watching him do service work. And I'm mentioning his name because he passed away a few months ago, and there's a lot of people here. He's touched our life so dearly. He was going to be down here speaking at the Loners International, I believe, on that committee. And the last conversation I had with him was at one of the other old-timers' funeral a couple days before he passed away. And he said, you tell Mary Lou I'm going to be there, and we're going to go down there, and we're all going to have a fun time. So this guy, Bill G., would give me advice over time, him and all the other old-timers. Like Walt J. would say, "Hey, kid, you can't stay sober on just being here. You got to do something. It's not like osmosis. It's not going to fall out of the sky and land on your lap. You got to find a higher power, and you got to believe in something. You got to work the steps if you want to change the attitude." He said, "We can take you out of that project, but you got to take the project out of you." And I had attitude. And at 18 months sober, I heard a guy speak, and the pain was bad enough that I wanted to go to the bar room and hang with my buddies because I knew what they were doing on a Friday night. And the pain with the motivator for me was asking for help and saying, "I heard you say higher power, not G-O-D. And he said, "Yeah." You go, "I keep it simple." And he said, "Would you like to go to a cup of coffee?" And I said, "Sure, I'd like to hear about the higher power because I don't know about the word G-O-D. And he said, "Okay." He said, "When you go home at night, I want you to throw your keys under your bed, and while you're down in the morning looking for them to go to work in the morning, say a little prayer to stay sober. Simple as that. You can call it whatever you want." He said, "I use G-O-D as a group of drunks. You see everybody in this room? There's unity. We help each other." And that's how I started praying to a higher power 18 months sober. And I have done it every day. And they taught me how to read the big book every day. My favorite page is about Dr. Paul, and he's talking about Max, his wife, about acceptance, life on life's terms. I read that every day. I go back to 60 to 63 when I think I'm running the show. I got to get out of the way. My sponsor tells me, sometimes you don't want to sit in the passenger seat. You might need to get in the back seat because you can still reach the wheel. Which I know, I'm a control freak, and I'm an organized person, and if you're not doing it my way, I usually let you know. And some people I offend, and I try not to do that today, and I'm aware of it. You guys have taught me that I can be aware of things. And then, so pain is a motivator for me over the years. I was 5 years sober. I found a higher power. I'm reading the big book every day. I read meditation. I'm praying. I have a sponsor. I've worked the steps at this point. And, I have sponsees. I'm hanging with people my own age in A, in our 20s. And I left the neighborhood where I used to go, which was the project. On Friday night, I'd be a year and a half sober, going out there, hanging out, going, "Hey, what's happening tonight?" Because I'm missing the excitement. And I knew what was going on with the crazy stuff we did. And some of the old-timers, they said, "Kid, monkey see, monkey do." I go, "What do you mean by that?" "You keep going to that neighborhood, it's like a barbershop. Sooner or later, you're going to get a haircut." I go, I had long blonde hair and a big old porn mustache going on, and I said, I "don't want a haircut." And they said, "Monkey see, monkey do. You want what we have, you do what we do. You find a sponsor, you find out who's hanging around, not the people in the social peanut gallery out back. First three rows, come, sit, listen, Come, like Father Martin used to say, come 20 minutes early, leave 20 minutes late. Listen to what's happening. Sometimes you get more out of a conversation. Somebody might give you some input, or you might even say something that might help somebody and get out of yourself that day. And so 5 years sober, I think I got it. I'm in my 20s. I'm very selfish. I'm hunting, I'm fishing, I'm playing softball in a men's league. I play in a keg league on Sunday with a bunch of drunks. And I don't know how to live in a relationship, and I'm married at this point. I don't know how to live with a woman. So I'm having a little struggle. I go to a meeting every day, and all of a sudden my wife says, I think we need to go to counseling. And I'm like, what for? She said, you have no compassion, which I knew. I didn't learn that. My mother was married 5 times. I knew what not to do. So the pain for me was my wife at that time said, we need counseling. And I said, I don't need counseling. I'm not going to counseling. There's just no way that's happening. I thought I had it pretty good doing what I was doing by just praying every day, finding a higher power, reading a big book, and working with people. I changed my life. I wasn't doing the same things. I dressed a little differently. Hair was probably pretty long by that time still. And that was the end of the conversation. Next day, she comes home and passes me some papers and said, you want to sign these? These are divorce papers. And I said, let's go to counseling. And she said, too late. So when Eva talked to me about pain, I said, I got pain. You know it. My stubbornness cost me that relationship. She divorced me, and I went to see a guy in the men's movement, Dan Arr, up in Maine. He wrote a couple books, and he taught me how to read self-help books. And he said, you need to live alone, kid, for a year. You need to stay out of a relationship. If you have a woman friend, you talk to her. You don't go to movies. You don't do anything. You hang out with your buddies, and you go to a men's step meet every week, and you work on you. And you get an apartment, and you learn how to have a checkbook, and you learn how to have your own dishes, clean your own dishes, do your own laundry, and don't rely on a woman for a year. And I said, okay. Pain was the motivator. My wife walked out of divorce court. I was with my buddy Mikey T that passed away. He was there for support, and we had the big book in our hand. And she looked at me, and the last thing she said to me, she said, you are going to die a lonely man. And I heard what she said. The pain was here that I was too stubborn. I was a little punk still, 5 years sober. And I didn't think about drinking. I thought about killing myself. That's where my mind goes. I got a little wire up there that just wants to end things when things go tough. And I don't know. I've talked to some people over the years, and they identify with that. And needless to say, we got divorced. And I went on a little recovery plan, and after a year, I became a different man. I learned how to become a man that year. I did all the things they suggested, and the pain was just bad enough that it put me in a funk. And people like Mikey T used to come to my apartment, help me do the dishes, and drag me to a meeting every day. Every day. Get out of the house. Let's go. Let's go for a walk. Let's go down the Oaks, down in Portland. Let's go. You know, you guys kept me sober, because I didn't want to live. I had no hope at 5 years sober. So this old guy says, hey, this too shall pass. You're not always going to live in that funk. Life's going to go on. Back then it was page 449, life on life's terms, acceptance, people, places, and things. And I did that, and time got better, and I learned how to have compassion, and I learned how to get in relationships, and I met a woman, and I got married, and I have 2 daughters now, 14 and 19. And they've never heard me drop an F-bomb. And I'm very proud of that, because I grew up in a house that was very common. My mother was a very abusive alcoholic. I saw a lot of men come into my house and leave, because my mother died a lonely woman. I broke the chain, and those people in AA taught me how to respect Alcoholics Anonymous, not talk about drugs, leave it elsewhere, leave it at the door. And I do that today. I was a year on a commitment. And the guy took me aside and he said, hey, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. You might want to talk about that other stuff in another place. And he said, by the way, you know, lack of profanity offends no one. And ever since then, I was just a young punk. I didn't know any better. I didn't have any guidance until these people started telling me how to speak and how to live. And ever since then, I haven't dropped an F-bomb in a meeting, and my kids have never heard me swear, and that is a miracle. Because where I come from, it was no hope. Every kid got out of the house, and we lived on the streets, and we didn't want to go home. And over time, the pain for me usually is the motivator to do something. And I'm learning how to see something early before it gets too bad, because there is hope today. You guys have given me hope. I want to live today. I have my own business. I'm self-employed. I didn't dare to do that stuff. My sponsor said, go out on the limb and jump on it. You can do it. You know, you can sell yourself. You have that in you. And I did it. And I've been doing it for 15 years. And it was scary, but I did it. You know, there's this thing I talk about, fear. I look it right in the eye every day, and I have faith today, and I'm okay with it. I don't live in fear. If you had seen me when I came in here at 23, and there's a few people that can remember me nowadays, even though I'm bald, I'm a different person. You guys have made me that way. So as time has gone long, years are piling up. My dad passes away. He was never in my life. Somehow I'm the power of attorney. I got to resent me with this guy. I'm named after him, but he was never in my life. He never bought me a birthday card or a present. I volunteered at the recovery center. I went in there one time to talk in the detox, and there he is in his pajamas. And I'm like, ooh. I said, I can't go in that room. This guy's my dad. He didn't even know who I was. He couldn't recognize me. But after that day, I talked to him and said, hey, just want to let you know I'm your son. And we met for coffee. A couple weeks later, he got out of detox. He wouldn't stop drinking. He died a drunk. But I made that initial contact and said, hey, I just want to let you know who I am, and it's okay. And I got to talk to him before he passed away. So my mom dies about 8-9 years ago, and I didn't think I loved her that much until after she was gone. So when she had a couple surgeries, and the pain just to talk to her or give her a hug and say, I love you, was too much for me. I couldn't do it. I had a hard time hugging her and saying, I love you. We just kind of knew it. Every year I'd get an anniversary card. On my anniversary, she said, hey, I'm proud of you, on a card. But she could never say it. So she's on her deathbed. I'm the only one there. I get the call. We rush her in. Nobody else is there. And she starts telling me her fifth step about her life story. And I'm like, holy cow, why are you telling me this stuff? This woman's an alcoholic. She's not one of us. She's a practicing drunk. She went into the hospital on a heart surgery with two cigarettes in her hand, smoking like this. She is an addict to the max. And I had a conversation with her before she passed away, and it was unbelievable. And I visited her at a grave today on Mother's Day. I went up and said, hey, hope Elvis is doing awesome up there. Tell him I said hi. I grew up hating Elvis music. My mother played all the records, the scratchy with the coffee brandy and the scratches going on. Loved Elvis 24/7. That's all I heard growing up. I hated him. And I'm a heavy metal headbanger from the 70s and 80s. I still go to concerts with my buddies over here. We volunteer at the State Theater so we can see free shows. It's unbelievable. We get to have fun with people in sobriety, and live music works for me. That's my medicine, live entertainment. So my mom passes away, and I realize I miss her. And the pain for me was I got to talk to her before I left. So I'll wrap it up. I've changed my life. You guys have taught me how to live, and I do it every day. I woke up this morning with untreated alcoholism. I prayed. I read my big book. I read a meditation book. And I've talked to a bunch of you people already. I'm here because I threw my name in a hat, and they drew it out of a hat, I guess. And there's two of us remain speaking down here, and there's a lot of people. It's just a miracle that I'm here, even though I didn't want to live, I know, a long time ago. So last fall, my brother passes away, and I'll wrap it up with this. He's a drunk. We fought. We've gone toe-to-toe over the years. I've had resentments with him. And he's had diabetes for 50 years from insulin, and his organs have failed, and his diet, the feet, you know how it all goes, and everything fails. And the night before he dies, he has a conversation with me. He says, I want you to speak at my funeral. And I'm like, wow, why for? And he said, I heard you speak at Ma's funeral, and I couldn't say nothing, and you sounded pretty good. I said, I did? I don't remember what I said. I said, you sure? He said, yeah. He He's got three kids. He said, I want you to take care of them. Be there. So the pain of letting go of that resentment and saying, I'll speak, no problem. That's fine. I said, I'll speak, no problem. He died like an hour later. I spoke at his funeral. Big Elvis fan. Big Elvis fan he was. I'm going to wrap it up with this. They're playing Elvis music the whole time while his funeral's going on. Happened at my mother's, my father's, and I'm telling you what, when music goes on, I start crying. Something about music, I just start crying. It's unbelievable. I was mowing my lawn the other day, and I'm listening to my iPod, and I'm listening to Elvis music. I actually think he's pretty talented. There was a song called In the Ghetto, and I was listening to it while I was mowing the lawn the other day, and that kid was me, and today he's not. Thanks for helping me stay sober today.
Thank you so much, Jim. You're more kind than I am. I came in at 16 years old, and I thought 30 was old, not 50. I don't think that anymore. I am very grateful that Bartholomew was able to get here. Yay! If I'm correct, you had to navigate elevators like I have, right? The bus. Okay, all right. So I am so glad that you made it here. I know Garen is very glad that you made it here. And so without further ado, I'll introduce Bartholomew C. from California.
Good morning. I walked into this room and I started to turn around and walk back out after rushing all over. My name is Bartholomew and I'm a recovered addict and alcoholic. I got a letter asking me to be on this panel and I thought, what? Pain doesn't exist. And of course, the minute I said it doesn't exist, it hit me that, well, yes, it does. What I've learned, just to give you a little background, I just celebrated June 3rd, 31 years of being clean and sober. Thank you. And I was 31 years of dealing with emotional pain. One of the things that I've learned about me living, is that I really feel very strongly that my pain really began at birth. And I tell you, it's a very emotional. I've gone many meetings and I don't like to share, but when I'm asked, I do. I never volunteer. I never volunteer to be a sponsor for anyone. If I'm asked, I do. And if they don't do the step, then I can't be your sponsor. So I always try to take. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. There we go. Okay, it's this weather from California, from San Francisco. It was cold and foggy yesterday morning when I left. Is that, as I mentioned, you may not heard that I think my pain, when I begin into recovery, I think my pain began at birth. And it's a very intimate, something I don't share very often because sometimes I still deal with it. But when I was 7 years old, actually I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I moved from there when I was 16. Thank you. Is that my aunt, when I was 7 years old, told me about my birth. She was my mother's birth, what do you call it? Midwife. Right. Still, the emotional pain is there. She told me that when my mother was ready to deliver me, they were rushed to the hospital, actually to Charity Hospital in New Orleans. And this was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And when she got there, she was told that this, at that time, it was a colored section and a white section. And at that time, they told her she had to come back after 6 when the code section was open. And so she went back home, and therefore, I was born at home. And my aunt delivered me, and she told me, she said, you were just incredible. And when I look back on it and think about it, is that I didn't want to be born in a segregated hospital. And so that's how I dealt with the pain. When you come in sobriety, you did this really happen to me? And I just want to preface this before I go any further. If there's anything that I like to share with you and leave you with, is that emotional pain to me causes physical pain, and physical pain causes emotional pain. And we are going to deal with this for the rest of our lives, because I know I am. But, however, whether you are experiencing emotional pain or physical pain, it's about healing. And I think when you're in pain, to me, it's an indication, it's very indicative of the fact that you need to start healing. Something's going wrong. And when we do the steps, this is where the emotional pain really began. And how I do my steps, and I want to share with you because it brings up every year. This year, June 3rd, I started my first step all over again for the 30th time. And I meditate on this step each month, and it's still that, damn it, I am, my life is manageable. And I do have power over people, places, again, pain and whatever, but I can't deal with world news tonight. That's the emotional pain that you can't deal with. And so, in dealing with the emotional pain, you have to do the steps. And as I said earlier, if someone asked me to be their sponsor, and I said, okay, you got to do the steps, and if they don't want to do the steps, I'm not going to be their sponsor. I've taken the steps, and I made it my own way of stepping through life and stepping through my own emotional pain and recovery. And recovery is really the key to healing, whatever pain you're going into or you're experiencing at the time. Whether you're going through surgery or not, there's emotional. I think 50% of healing is the emotions that takes care of the physical. And emotional pain, to me, is where when you begin to recognize, especially when I begin to recognize, that while there's a lot of emotional pain that's been going on with me, is that this is where I begin my dialogue with God, whom I choose to be my power greater than myself. There's a lot of growing up with pain. Growing up in the South and then moving to California, which to me was like a whole different world. Going through the military, being a paramedic in Vietnam, a Vietnam vet, and believe me, going through PTSD counseling. That's where really the emotional pain. And for those of you, I want to share, if any veterans in here, is that for me, is that I'm comfortable with dealing with PTSD. It's never going to go away for me. But it's a very emotional growth. And this is where when you start dealing with your emotional pain, the growth starts inwardly. All of your systems in your body are set up to help you deal with your emotions. And like the first step, again, how I've adapted the steps, the first step is my respiratory system. And each month, like I started meditating on my respiratory system. And that gives me the manageability and power over my life and fright. You know, like right now I'm pretty relaxed because I know that what really is healing about pain is being honest and telling the truth. And believe me, in my state of sobriety today, my natural high is telling the truth. Some of my friends or family members say, well, you have to always be so honest. You know? And I say, because it's the truth. You know, believe me, I have a large family, and I have to deal with a lot of their dishonesty. And when I discovered that my life wasn't the way that I wanted it to be, that's when I started drinking a lot. I didn't drink. I grew up with a father who was a jazz player, who was a saxophone player, and I used to steal my father's cigarettes and his cocaine also. And of course, my grandmother used to leave a little beer for me, you know, in her bottle all the time. So it was acceptable. And so growing up through life, I thought that was also acceptable. But then again, you get to the point where the acceptability goes out of the window because it's out of control. And I spent a lot of time trying to get drinking, and using drugs in control. And it's not possible to do it. So the second step is, it has to do with healing the internal aspect of my body. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That's my skeletal system. What's more sane than your skeletal system? And I meditate on that each second month of my recovery. And I'll just go through the third step is turning your life and your will to a power greater than yourself. And that's my central nervous system. There's where a lot of healing begins, in your mental capacity. Today, I do a lot of healing to others because I'm a therapist. And my healing was going back to school and getting my degree as a substance abuse counselor. And I work with the San Francisco Drug Court. And I am so glad that and happy that I'm clean and sober today. Because some of the drugs that are out there right now, I definitely would be dead. And some of the drugs out there right now, it's hard to heal from. And some of the drugs right now are still trying to get rid of the pain, the emotional pain. And it's a vicious cycle. It's calamity. I work with do a lot of assessments in the jails. And I'm not hopeless, but there's a lot of hopelessness that goes along with people out there doing drugs today. And I look at this room, if each one person would grapple with someone and said, listen, you're killing yourself and you're killing the pain. You're going to take the pain with you. And you won't know what the pain was really all about. But the joy of is finding out what the emotional pain is about. And life can really help you heal from those emotional pain. Embracing life is also a key to me to deal with emotional and physical pain. You embrace life, what, again, I can't emphasize it enough, honesty and truth. And that's my adrenaline flow, is to be truth and to be honest. And the fourth step, which a lot of people I find have a lot of difficulty with, is making an inventory of a life. And that's my cardiovascular system. Each month in my fourth month each year, I meditate the whole month on my cardiovascular system. And it's quite healthy. Although, the heart is to me the power mechanism of the pain that we all go with. It's that pain of being in love, you know. And when you're in love and love doesn't work, is that you have spent a lot of time wondering why didn't it work. Because the pain is so intense of love. And I really encourage people that are newly in sobriety is that don't get into a relationship. At least for 2 years. No! Work on yourself for 2 years. You are your best lover. And to love yourself, to me, is the epitome of healing. So you find your way, and I'm just sharing with you briefly how I found my way to deal with the emotional pain, to deal with what's going on in society today, is that I don't really want to look at TV anymore because of all the violence. And that's embedded into your own psyche. You know, you're looking at the pain that people are going through all over the world. But being clean and sober is that you can deal with it. My whole philosophy of me dealing with emotional pain and that touchstone of growth is that I don't drink and use drugs for the same reason that I did. So you can take that and internalize it and see if it could fit into your process of healing, because it can carry you a long way when you're in one of those situations. Life is, you know, I'm not going to stand here and tell you life is all that good, but however, it's good because I want it to be good and I work hard to make it good. And I know what healing is about because it's mine and no one can stop me from healing the way that I want to. as long as I don't take that first drink, because I know that if I do, I'm not coming back. So therefore, I want to stay. And that's good enough reason. Just keep the healing going and have healing to me as my touch tone of growth. It's an infinite. And if you can grab hold onto it, not as a crutch, but as an awakening, as an awareness. And because of my philosophy and my work and my commitment to my recovery process is that I want to die with awareness. And that means that I'm in control and I want to join the grace that I deserve while I'm in this state of recovery and this state of healing. And right now I feel a lot of healing from everyone in this room. And I'm going to be selfish and I'll take it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bartholomew. I'm so glad you made it here. Next, I'd like to introduce Deb H. from Ohio/California. And she's good, too, because she's been to Pocatello and said she really likes it in Idaho. So,
oh, good morning, everyone. My name is Deb. I'm a real alcoholic. Hi. Gosh, I mean, I always say that it's an honor and a privilege to be somewhere and do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's not only an honor and a privilege, it's like freaking overwhelming to be asked to speak at the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be part of, as we all are, to be part of the celebration of 80 years. I mean, man, isn't that cool? You know, And I would just like to ask all of you, what are you doing in this room? At 11 a.m. on Friday, when I'm getting ready to start a weekend-long party, I'm not going to a session where the first word in the title is pain. I'm just saying. You know, you might need to take a look at why it is you chose this workshop. I don't know, maybe all the other rooms closed first. That happens. I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and sat all the way down and stayed, beginning March 15th, 1987. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. I would just like to say to Jim, I'm not sure what took you so long. I walked into AA when I was 15. You were out there running for an extra 8 years, a little bit of a slow learner on the end down there. What? Oh, I was born and raised in a really small town right outside of Akron, Ohio. I had no idea that I was growing up close to the mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous, nor did I care. You know, there were people getting sober and staying sober and doing all kinds of work for Alcoholics Anonymous just up the road from me, and it just wasn't even on my radar. I was one of those kids that grew up in an alcoholic family, and my dad was one of those violent alcoholics, and even when he wasn't drinking, he was mean. And we were just absolutely terrified all the time. I began drinking when I was 9 years old. And I drank when I was 9 years old because I was curious. I just wanted to know why that stuff in those dark little bottles was so darned important. It was important to my dad that he have a lot of it, and it was important to my mom that he have none of it. And there is a basic conflict of interest in the house, and it caused all kinds of strife and struggle. And when I was 9 years old and I drank alcohol for the first time, I had a feeling of overwhelming relief that I didn't know that I needed. I'm telling you, my shoulders came off my ears and my little fists let loose and I exhaled all the way for the very first time. And I thought, man, I get it. I get it. I understand why he drinks every day. I really, really do. And my mom, if she would just take a drink, everything would be fine. I mean, that woman is wound tight. And if she would just drink and chill out a little bit, she'd stop nagging and he'd stop being mad all the time and everybody would get along. I mean, it's just, man, this stuff rocks. And from that very first night. It was my first drink, my first drunk, my first blackout. The next day was my first hangover. It was the first time I felt shame about decisions I had made while intoxicated. And the only thing that I remembered when I sobered up was that feeling of overwhelming relief. And that's how my alcoholism started, and that's how my alcoholism ended. That feeling of overwhelming relief, I chased it every single time I put a bottle to my lips, and I tried to do it as often as I could. And that's alcoholism. That's the beginning of alcoholism. I have no idea how long I chose to do that until I crossed over and crossed in and developed that that physical allergy myself. I don't know. But what I do know is that for me, to drink means to continue to drink. It doesn't mean to drink is to die, because I was cool with that. When I got sober and walked into Alcoholics Anonymous for the very first time when I was 15 years old, when you looked at me and said, if you continue to drink, you'll die, I was like, please bring it. I mean, bring it. I'm good. I really am. The things that I lived through when I was a kid, the things that I brought on myself through my own drunken escapades, things that were done to me, things that I participated in, I was overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed with shame and grief and hatred for who I had become and for so many of the people around me. I hadn't drawn in a full breath or let out a full breath for years. I was just so full of shame that dying would have been fine with me. It was this constant living that was just absolutely too much. It really was constant living that was too much. I tried to drink myself to death one time before I landed in a treatment center in downtown Cleveland. Clearly it didn't work. I tried over and over and over. I chased down death for a solid week before I landed in that treatment center. And I just kept coming to, and I was just sicker and sicker and sicker. And when I got sobered up in that treatment center, I didn't want to be there, and I didn't want to be sober because I had no God. I had no tools. I had nothing to do with this head that was just running. I mean, just flat out running all the time. And I was so full of shame that I didn't want to be there, and I didn't want to be sober. I really didn't. I didn't know that there was ever a way that I could sort all that out and unpack it. I had no idea that there was a God who loved me, who had created me so that he could have a very, very special and intimate relationship with me, who had already forgiven me before I had asked, and who delivered me every single day from the brink of absolute destruction because he had work for me to do. I had no idea that there was a loving God out there just waiting for me to turn around and realize that he'd been in the shadows the entire time. And that it was through that relationship with God that I was going to get relief from the stuff that was going on in my head, from the stuff I was carrying in my body, for the things that had happened to me and the things I had participated in. I had no idea that there was relief. And I had no idea that just turning around and realizing that God was in those shadows and beginning to participate in a relationship with the intimate and ultimate power was possible or would restore me to wholeness. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was that I was 15. I hurt. Alcohol put me into oblivion. And I don't know why you guys keep getting in my way. And then I went to Alcoholics Anonymous because all of the adults in my life wouldn't leave me alone. And that was really, that was the truth of it. The adults in Alcoholics Anonymous, the adults in my family, the adults in my community, everybody finally started to get a beat on just how sick I was. And they just wouldn't leave me alone. When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous on March 15th, it was following a one-day relapse. There was an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he tossed me out of AA. That's how I tell it. He was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Mac Shadburn. He'd been sober since Christ was a child, and he was tired of me acting badly in AA meetings. So he asked me if I was an alcoholic. And I looked at him and I gave him the only answer that I had. My answer was, and he said, "Can you control your drinking?" And I thought, I don't know why you people are obsessed with controlling your drinking. I mean, who controls their drinking? Like, I take the top off, I throw the top away, I drink until I can't breathe, I'm good. You know? And so I gave him the only answer that I had. My answer was, and he gave me $5 and he said, "Here's $5, go find out. Go find out. Go see if you can drink and stop. And if you can't, you get back here if you can, I never want to see you again. And when I walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous after my experiment, by the grace of God, it only lasted one day, I was convinced that I could not take a drink of alcohol or two drinks of alcohol and stop. You see, I started to drink. It flipped the switch. I needed more, and I just continued to run. And I came to that next day coming out of a hellacious blackout, and I was beat up, and I was filthy, and I was black and blue, and I hurt, and I was sick one more time. And I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that afternoon. I got there on time. I sat in the middle, and I only had one cup of coffee, and I was not an annoyance or a disturbance. I got a sponsor, and all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous took an interest in making sure that I got onto the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which began my healing process. And so what they would do is they would come to my house at 7 o'clock every night. They would take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated all of them. I would sit through these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, behaving myself to the best of my ability. And then these old people who showed up to drive me to meetings, they would take me to the donut shop. And at the donut shop, I didn't want to go to the donut shop at 10 o'clock at night with 70-year-olds, but there I was. And at the donut shop, I would drink coffee, I would bum and smoke their cigarettes. I didn't know how to smoke, but I learned. And I would eat donuts, and I would listen to them tell me their stories. And they would tell me their stories about healing, and they would tell me their stories about restoration, and they would tell me how they had developed their own relationship with God. And they tricked me into working the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They did. They wouldn't let me speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, even a topic meeting, until I had finished my 12 steps. That was very annoying. I had a lot to say when I was 90 days sober. And they taught me how to pray in a donut shop after a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was this very annoying man, and every time I would take them my very, very large problems to the donut shop, he would say to me this very annoying thing. Did you pray about that? 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 And finally, I'd had enough. And I looked at him one night and I said, I don't know how. You see, I was raised in a family where there was no God. There was no recognition of God. I was raised in a family where we didn't pray. We didn't take anything to a higher power. Alcohol was the higher power, and the alcoholic was the manifestation of that power. So I had no idea about this God. And he said, did you pray about it? And I said, I don't know how. And he said, give me your book. And I slid my book across the table to him. He opened it up and he underlined and highlighted every tiny little prayer throughout the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He closed it, shoved it back, and he said, pick one and try it. On your knees. And he taught me how to pray. And what I can tell you is that through the last 28 years of being a faithful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not only has my understanding of who God is and who God isn't grown, but my experience with the power that is God has developed over the years. And that experience has been significant enough not only to allow me healing from what I came in here bringing, but to allow me to experience pain and not run from it, and to continue in this ongoing healing process. You know, where there is great pain, there is great opportunity for growth. It does not mean because there is great pain, there will be great growth. It means that there is opportunity for great growth when there is great pain. And I am so incredibly grateful that through the years, I have developed not only a father-daughter relationship with God, but God is also my best friend. He's been in my corner every single day. Every time I've needed him, every time I haven't needed him. He has always been there, and now I participate in that loving and expanding relationship of God. You know, when I got here, you know, God was good orderly direction, and my sponsor Jane said, God is good orderly direction. You don't have any, I'll be providing that. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of Jane. And slow but sure, my relationship and my experience with God has expanded and changed as my heart has opened up and as my mind has opened up, because you sit in meetings like this and you share with me your stories, and I think, that could be possible for me too. You know, the language of the heart works and continues to keep my heart open. And about 10 years ago, I started to be called to have a deeper and deeper relationship with God, and he was calling me to be baptized and to begin to have a Christian experience with him. And I would never, I mean, in a million years, you know, you said the J word and the hair was up on the back of my neck and we weren't having that. And did you not know that we separated ourselves from those people who came from the G squad a long time ago? And I mean, I was just one of those. And God kept calling me and calling me and calling me to have a deeper and more expansive relationship with him. And through that surrender and through having that experience with him, I was able to experience true love with another human being for the very first time. I had been married and divorced in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are bored in your home group, I highly suggest that. It's going to have everybody talking about everybody else and choosing sides, and there's all kinds of activity that comes with that. But I had met a man who was absolutely the love of my life. His name was Lee. He was a major in the Marine Corps. He was 6'1". He was bald-headed and blue-eyed, and he did the right thing for the right reasons all the time. And, I mean, he was awesome. And we played golf together, and we rode Harleys together, and he was just my kind of guy. And he and I joined the Catholic Church together, and we put God in the middle of our marriage, and we began to develop a spiritual language for one another, or with one another. And it was an incredible opportunity to really participate deeply in an experience with God. And he deployed to war. And if you ever want to get close to God, have a family member who deploys to war, and they're on the front lines because they're an infantry marine. And so he deploys to war, and I have no choice but to stay plugged into that power. I have no choice but to participate in the relationship that I have with God. You see, what I've come to understand is that when big things happen, I'm going to have to rely on the relationship I currently have with God, not with the relationship I wish I had. And so when he's deployed to war, I am going deeper and deeper into prayer. Deeper and deeper into prayer. I'm having a constant conversation with God. That whole pray without ceasing, that becomes real for me. And he comes back. And we bring him all the way home because the battlefield is a difficult place. And it takes us a while for him to come all the way home. 5 months later, he deploys again. And they go back to Afghanistan and they take the fight to the field to the Taliban. And they're losing men right and left. And on those rare opportunities when I would get to talk to him, we had a spiritual language. And so I was able to say things like, honey, how can I pray for you today? Not how can I pray for me to get relief from my fear and from my loneliness and my concern, but I was able to figure out what he needed me to pray for, and I was able to take that forward for him. And he came home. And everybody exhaled. And he was headed for retirement. And then he was killed on his way home from work. And I got that call, and it was at 9:30 at night, and I sat up straight up in bed, and I thought, oh my God. And I was living in the desert in California. And I was calling around trying to figure out where he was because he wasn't home and he wasn't home. And finally one of the captains got on the phone because I called the battalion and he told me, he said, Dev, I'm so sorry, but Lee was killed. And I could see the emergency lights down the hill and I just looked down there and I knew that that was the accident scene. And he said, please don't go down there. We're coming to you. Don't go down there. And I can tell you that when he said, I am so sorry, Deb, but Lee was killed on his way home from work tonight, the first thought that I can remember having was, God, I can't breathe, and I need you. And I can tell you that because I had been practicing, I'd had the incredible opportunity to walk through pain and fear and live in that deepening, ever-deepening relationship with God, I can tell you that when I had that thought and I asked God to come because I couldn't breathe, I had the physical sensation of God coming and wrapping me up from behind like a lover does when they're wrapping up their beloved. And what I heard in my ear was, I'm here. Not, it's going to be okay, it didn't happen, this is a nightmare, none of that. God just wrapped me up and said, I'm here. And I can tell you, I don't have the time to go into all the details. There are people in this room who walked through all of that with me. And it's the next day or 2 days later maybe. And there are old timers in my kitchen. Alcoholics Anonymous, the members came and they took over everything. Everything. and the Marines weren't sure what to do with you. And so there are all these people sitting around my house, and the old timers are around the kitchen table, and they're telling me, and they keep saying this over and over, it's okay for you to be angry with God. When the anger comes, just give it to God. Just go ahead and be angry with God. It's okay. He's big enough. He can take it. And I'm standing there and I'm listening to all of this because I listen to old timers. You guys taught me how to do that. And I'm listening and I think, I don't want to be angry with God. He's my best friend. I don't want to put anger between me and God. Why would I want to do that? There's got to be another way. There has got to be another way than being angry with God. I need God. I mean, I would crawl in bed at night and I would be crying myself to sleep and I'd say, God, please come sleep with me. And he would roll into bed and he'd spoon me. I don't want to put anger between me and that. There's got to be another way. And my phone rings and it's the most unlikely of characters. His name is Walter H. He's from Houston, Texas. He's been sober 40 years and he's the most unlikely of characters. But he's the man who calls me from time to time and says, God told me I needed to call and tell you something. And that day he called and he had to call three times to get through the people that had my phone. And he gets on the phone and he said, Deb, I am so incredibly sorry. He was an old Marine too. And he and Lee were big fans of one another. And he said, but God told me to call you right now and tell you that there are things that happen in this world that break his heart. And Lee's death was one of them, and he will be healing alongside you, so you can go ahead and rest in his arms. And I hung up the phone with Walter, and I was like, that's the other way. That's the other way. I don't have to get angry and put that anger between me and God. I can rest in his arms. I can trust the experience of having a loving God who embraces me, who made me, who adores me, and who will deliver me from absolutely anything if I'm willing to participate in that relationship. There's an enormous difference between step two, coming to believe, and walking through the rest of the steps where I build my own informed faith. That's an enormous journey. And when we make that journey, when the big things happen, I have the relationship with God that I need, not the one that I wish I had. Great pain brings great opportunity for growth. And what I can tell you is that today I don't have faith. I just know. I just know. And I finally have the Father I always wanted. Thank you.